Welcome to Chat Theology, the podcast about Scripture and God from the team at Leeds School of Theology. Our courses are accessible and open to all. Check us out at leedschooloftheology.org.
Welcome, everybody, to the latest episode of Chat Theology, a podcast hosted by Leeds School of Theology. My name's Dave Horsall, Director of Leeds School of Theology, going to be hosting today's podcast. And today we have with us Dr. Delroy Hall, and we're going to be looking at the practice of journaling and its role in how it helps you learn about yourself. So, Delroy, welcome to the podcast. It's lovely to have you with us.
Thank you, David. Yeah, and I just wanted to say that I just realised this is not a collar, as in a clerical collar. This is just a granddad shirt. So
in light of that, then, Delroy, tell us a bit about yourself. Tell us why you would or wouldn't be wearing a collar. Maybe tell us a bit about who you are, a bit about your story. What do you do?
Oh, gosh, right. Story. So first generation Windrush. So born in England, in Nottingham to be exact, in 1959. So I'm a little bit older than I look. Spent a lot of my years in Leicester, last 27 years in Sheffield. Pretty average at school. Didn't do particularly well with my GCSEs, but the life came, academic world came alive in my late 20s. So prior to that, though, I was an athlete, 400 meter hurdler.
A good athlete.
Well, yeah, number two in Great Britain when I was 20.
It's pretty good.
Yeah. It was a good time of life. I think one of the things I'll say that what I didn't realise that the discipline of training has kind of followed me all the way through, not just in athletics alone or sports. I do this in sports now, 50 years on, I'm still doing sports. But just in terms of discipline of studying, eating habits, starting something, finishing it, and that type of thing.
Yeah.
So by profession, trained counsellor, psychotherapist, have been for over 30-odd years. I was a Pentecostal pastor for 30 years. The last 10 years of that, I was a regional bishop. So now I work for myself as still a counsellor, but doing less counselling now, doing more consultancy work and training around racial trauma, also supporting people who've been traumatized through one thing or another. And I do a broadcast on Tuesday nights. So
you're quite an unusual figure, because a Pentecostal minister and also a psychotherapist, that is quite an unusual mix.
Oh yeah, I spoke to a sports psychologist recently. He was a Christian, and he could not believe I was a Pentecostal minister and a psychodynamic psychotherapist, because psychodynamic is kind of from the Freudian school. I'm not a Freudian, but the kind of Freudian school. He just couldn't believe that ever was possible, but it's really possible. So I've made it work for the last 30-odd years. But then making it work has created some tension.
Yeah.
But it's been, tension has been quite creative. In terms of ministry and helping people.
Yeah, that's really helpful. And just quickly on that tension, that intrigues me a little bit. My understanding of that would be the tension would be between kind of an approach that's like, you know, just read the Bible, just pray, just kind of be filled with the Spirit afresh, versus a kind of more psychological, like, no, we need to understand the roots of things and how this is playing out in your kind of mental well-being. Is that the kind of tension?
Yeah. Yeah. However, so within Caribbean culture, for example, mental illness is seen, well, it's changing a bit, but still seen as something to do with spirits and all that type of stuff. And that was a view that we had at the church I was at until I did some work at Rampton Hospital, which is a kind of high security or maximum security hospital.
Yeah.
People who had severe psychiatric illness. Anyway, there was a real problem with having patients, but also people being supportive whilst they're inside. And I remember they approached me and I made an appeal. And I remember the night, 15 guys, because mainly men, 15 guys turned up. I was shocked.
Yeah.
We started this project over 20-odd years ago. It's still going.
Wow.
I'm not involved in it now, but it's still going. So people's mind has begun to shift that maybe it's more than just spirit, but it's other things going on in people's lives as well. So having that understanding. So if I hear somebody say, it's the work of the devil, I know what that means.
Yes.
So I can interpret that. Yeah. And I don't then, as somebody else might do, you know, kind of report them. But then I understand what that means. And I said, well, you know, possibly another perspective to this. So,
Yeah, really helpful. Well, that's not where we're going today, although that would be a fascinating podcast. Where we're going today is we're looking at this, we're introducing this kind of idea or this kind of practice of journaling, pastoral journaling. The way we're going to pitch this, Delroy, is I struggle with journaling and you're going to help me through and you're going to tell me why it would be helpful for me and also a little bit about how I could do it. But let's just introduce the conversation first. What do you mean? What do you understand by what journaling is? How would you describe it to someone?
Right. Journaling for me is the way of capturing your experiences, thoughts, ideas about an experience that you've had. Very different from a diary. Diary is more about dates, appointments, when I'm going to meet at such and such a particular time. But journaling for me is then I've just had this experience. It could be a positive experience. Or certainly an unpleasant experience. So how can I learn from what I've just experienced than just being angry, full of rage, and blaming everybody else?
That's a really helpful distinction. So rather than this being, I went to the shops, I walked the dog, I saw my mum. This is something has happened today that's caused a reaction in me of some kind, joy, anger. So like, what's going on there? Like digging down deeper.
Yeah.
And why is that important? Why can't I just, you know, feel what I feel and go to sleep and wake up in the morning, feel better?
Right. So psychologist Susan Davy talks about emotions are data. So if we have unpleasant emotions, it's saying something. But what we tend to do on a whole matter of things, sweep it under the carpet, bury our head in the sands, but it's an invitation for inquiry, for curiosity. Something within us is calling out for attention, and it's begging us to kind of do some exploration work.
Yeah.
And I think having an understanding of our internal world is really important for ministry, but quite often it's not taken as being serious, really. But the interior world, I think, is really important.
Yeah, I think that's really helpful. We had the podcast that will probably go out before this one, we had a conversation with a pastor who's done a lot of work around discipleship, and he was talking about a passage in 2 Timothy where Paul says to Timothy, like, watch your life and your doctrine closely. And that kind of idea of what does watching your life mean? And some of that is obviously like external behaviors, like watch how you're talking, how you're acting. But so much of it is also like what's going on inside you, like where are you at and how are you responding to things?
Sure.
I remember chatting to a friend of mine, a Baptist minister friend of mine, who's a trained counselor as well, years ago when I was immature and didn't know things, don't worry. I was talking to him about, I was like, oh, whenever I get frustrated, I'll let it out on I'll bang a wall or I'll kick the car tire or something like that. And we had a long chat, and at the end he said, oh, what the way I describe it is emotional leakage, which is probably the most disgusting phrase that I've ever heard. But something that really stuck with me, and I like the phrase that you just used, that emotions are data, that those impulsive and maybe unpleasant reactions reveal something about the inner world. They say something about what's going on. So kind of nail this down for us in terms of what's this look like in your life? How have you used this tool of journaling? How has it been helpful for you? How did it start?
Okay, well, it started, I thought this question, it started off with a girlfriend I had when I was 16.
Yeah.
And then, I don't think you should be listening to this now. Her name is Dawn Harding. She introduced me to that. And then I did it for a while. And then we fell out. And then I stopped. And then over the years, I kind of played around with it until I read an excellent book called Order in Your Private World by Gordon MacDonald. Brilliant devotional book. And at the end of each chapter, a series of questions, but also he recommended one page of journaling. I think it was the morning after the night before, I think it was. So I did that and worked through the book and found it helpful. And then I was pastoring in one of my first pastorates in one of our kind of flagship churches in the Church of Prophecy. And there was just loads of conflict in the congregation, just stacks of it. I now know and think believe that whoever the founding minister was of the congregation leaves their DNA on the kind of development of the church. So the founding bishop was a pugilist. And if there's any young people watching, that pugilist is a posh word for a boxer. He was just a, he just he was just the conflict just exuded him. Everything was a stand-up row for him.
Yeah,
So
okay.
there's lots of conflict going on in the congregation, and I couldn't understand what was going on. So in the black majority church, you're the pastor, so you are the expert.
Yeah.
So it's no point asking anybody else what their thoughts are. You are the expert. You're the one in
Yeah.
charge. And it wasn't making any head or tail. And I just remembered Gordon MacDonald's, the Post journalist. Two things happened. As I wrote, I realized that I caused some of the conflict by just not knowing the people. And the second thing, at an intuitive level, I asked the question one day, and Pentecostal pastors shouldn't use language like this. I just thought, who the hell are these people anyway? So then what that did, that so mainly from Jamaica. So then I started to look at the history of Jamaica and the journals and trying to understand not only this congregation, but many congregations like it, and the community of people. I wanted to understand the history of Jamaican people. That's what led me to this whole thing around slavery. And my PhD really looked at essentially if you use gratuitous violence as a form of social control for two or three centuries, what does it do to people? And I think I saw behaviors displayed in the community, which were kind of consistent with people who'd been under oppression.
Yeah, interesting.
But they themselves, because it was so far removed from that, they didn't even know what was going on. So it was just, so it was really interesting for me at that time, using the process of journaling to understand what was going on. But secondly, I'm more of a teacher than a preacher, so I didn't fit the kind of black majority church pastor. I was very kind of stayed. I worked through a book, so I started in chapter one, verse one, and I'd work all the way through it, which was very uncommon. So they're very critical of my style. So as I journaled that, new learnings would pop up. So what I did for about 4 or 5 years, I put post-it notes on the lectern before I preached to remind me of either to say certain or not say certain things. And that's how I developed as a preacher, really. It
Yeah,
was just
interesting.
listening to the comments, the critical comments at times, and then taking it on board, even though some of it I didn't like, using it. I really didn't like it because it really kind of made me feel incompetent and all that type of thing. But I used it, wrote about it, reflected on it, and then some new learnings came, and then I put the new learnings into operation, reflected on it again, and then I just became a better speaker over time.
So that's really interesting. So the journaling is, it's not just a tool for understanding yourself, but it's actually also a tool for almost reflecting on your situation, your context, and to some extent almost improving as a practitioner, improving as
Oh,
somebody
absolutely.
in your context, like how can I do this better, taking on board what they're saying. It not just a place of going, oh, why am I annoyed that they keep criticizing me, although it is a place of that, but also going, well, what does it look like to learn from that?
It's funny, I was as you've mentioned that I remembered when I went to the States, my best friend, his name's Delroy, he's a Baptist minister. And in the Caribbean, Pentecostal, well, it might have changed a bit now, but Pentecostals and Baptists don't get on. So Pentecostals believe that Baptists are not saved, and Baptists believe that Pentecostals are too emotional. But we became best friends. And he was driving me back to the airport. I spent 2 weeks with him, and I spent a week with him. And he was driving back to the airport, and he said to me, "Where did you do your training?" And I said, "On the job." And I had to tell him, I had to remind him he was on the highway, he's on the motorway in America, because he was shocked. And it was years later when I thought, well, how did I develop as a pastor? And I read a lot about leadership, but do you know what? It was the reflecting on the lived experience and learning from it that really honed me to become a better leader.
So that's interesting because lots of people will say that on the job training, on the job learning is, you know, the best way of doing it rather than being in a classroom. But to some extent, it sounds like what you're saying is yes, but only if you're not only if, but the way you maximize that is you're paying attention to how the classroom is teaching you, as it were, how the context is teaching you.
Absolutely correct. Yes, absolutely correct. I think, and I think part of my sadness is when people graduate, because reflective practice is taught, social workers, counselling.
Yeah.
Quite often when we graduate, we never pick up a book again. We never pick up that reflective practice again. But for this is very personal. For me, if anybody says to me now, what really developed you as a pastor, I would say, using the context, the experience to teach me how to be a better practitioner, pastor, leader, whatever. So
what happened? What do you think the downside of not doing it is? What would be, maybe even if you thought about if I stopped doing this, or just generally, what do you think the potential consequences are for that lack of self-reflective engagement, but also just that if you were like, oh, I'm just going to stop journaling tomorrow, what effect do you think that would have on you?
Right. Few things. One, you're then prone to make the same mistake again.
It's really helpful.
So essentially, you know, you're not learning.
Yeah.
Secondly, something might be happening on your very nose, but because you're not paying attention to it, you miss it.
Yeah.
To stop journaling, and I did for a period of time stop journaling when I was in my last pastorate. The reason why I stopped, essentially, I knew what the journals were telling me and I wasn't prepared to face it.
Yeah, okay.
I really should have left the congregation far earlier than I did.
Yeah.
And I ignored all the signs, and I ended up in hospital with severe chronic stress.
Yeah.
Really bad eczema and led to shedding skin. I was really
wet. Yeah.
And I'd not journaled for a long while, and I knew what I was doing. Because it meant making a decision which I wasn't prepared to make at that time.
Yeah.
Because within Black minority churches, whether it's in Africa, America, or India, once you're a pastor, you don't resign.
Yeah.
So the truth of journaling, or the process of journaling, was leading me to a place of, Daryl, you need to walk away from this.
Yeah.
It was so countercultural.
That's interesting.
I wasn't able to deal with it.
So sometimes the journaling, the self-reflection can reveal something to you, but that what it reveals is, it's, to some extent, it's so earth-changing or earth-shattering that sounds like a trying to understand the context as I do, or like my interaction with it as I've had, I can understand how significant a move that would have been to say, I'm stepping away from this.
Yeah. So in the end, what led me to walk away was being physically sick.
Yeah.
And people, it's Pentecost, we talk about God's time and all the rest of it. And I kicked that stuff into touch years ago. Because I think sometimes we have common sense, which we need to make a decision today.
Yeah.
But what we do, and for me, it was loyalty. It was a friend of mine who said something to me. It was really important. He said, you know, Delroy, loyalty is a great thing, but loyalty can kill you.
Yeah.
And he was right. Loyal to the T. When I look back now, I put up with some stuff I shouldn't have put up with.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And in the end, it was sickness that caused me to leave.
And that is a difficult one, isn't it? Because you can end up sticking with something and staying with something for a ostensibly what looks like a really good reason and a really Christian reason.
Yeah,
I love the people.
Correct,
I'm loyal to them. I've got a role to play. I've got gifting to. But actually. And on the surface, that can look good and godly and right.
Yeah, yeah.
But actually, you know, God can be at work behind the scenes being like, this is all good, but it's time. Yeah. It's time to walk away. It's time to move on.
Yeah. If you've got models around you who've done it before, it's easier, but I didn't have that.
Yeah, yeah.
So, because I think a few people have said to me they'd never known anybody who'd got to my position in the church. I was a regional bishop.
Yeah.
Oversight of 8 congregations. I sat on the international committee, one of them.
Wow. Yeah.
Nobody walks away from that. You know, you've kind of made it. And now in the end, it nearly killed me, really, in the end.
That's fascinating. I don't want to divert too much, but I'm intrigued now. This is why my podcast is always going on too long. But so that I find it fascinating that journey into ministry but also out of ministry, and we've got loads of stuff loads of models for how to go into ministry, loads of books on calling and that kind of thing. But you get very little on what it looks like, what the signs are that it's time to step away. And it does seem as though it's clouded with a bit of kind of sense of shame or failure.
And so
my story is not as extreme as yours, but I was in pastoral ministry for 5 or 6 years, not 30 years. But got to a point where I was like, I feel like it's time to move to a different form of ministry, into kind of a more teaching ministry. But there was no model. There was like no way of going, right, well, there's this, this, and this. These are all the tick boxes of going, yeah, this seems like the right moment. So you are left a little bit kind of just on your own, figuring it out, being like, do I do this? Do I not? Lots of the voices influencing you are kind of saying, why on earth would you? That's quite a hard, it is a very difficult kind of transition to go through.
It is. I remember the January of 2018 I announced my resignation in April, and then I officially left July, which is very interesting. The last weekend, which I should have been in the congregation, I was actually in hospital. Now, as a psychotherapist, that has major symbolism and meaning, and shedding of skin as well. My daughter said, you know, Dad, you really need to write about this. So, and I said, yeah, well, we'll do. I think January...
we'll do when I'm out of hospital. I'm feeling better.
that's actually been a bit unfair myself, because I've actually started putting some ideas together.
Yeah, that's so good.
January 2018, I remember going, I normally go to, if I want some time away, historically I went to Woodbrook, the Quaker Study Centre in Birmingham. Lovely place, really nice and quiet, even though I'm not a Quaker, but I like the tradition of silence, which very un-Pentecostal. I wasn't able to get there, so I stayed in a hotel in the middle of Birmingham. I got loads of friends in Birmingham, but I told nobody that I was going to be there. I was there for 4 days. And I remember the Sunday morning, had breakfast, went back to the room, but the housemaid was cleaning the room out. Went back downstairs, and I remember sitting in the foyer, the lounge area, TV was on, but silent. And I remember mulling over my mind about leaving.
Yeah.
And if anybody gets to know me well, I'm really cautious about, you'll not hear me say, the Lord said, or the Lord said. But I certainly, as I was mulling, musing this in my mind, I guess I was in a meditative state, I suppose. Yeah. I've heard very clearly, because I was thinking, well, pastors, when they leave, they say they're taking the church as far as they can do. And I'm thinking, I'm not saying that. And I heard very clearly, Delroy, you have a lot more to give, but not here.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah.
Heard that, and it stayed with me, but I didn't say anything to anybody, and it stayed with me for about 2 or 3 months. One day I was in the last pastorate, and one of the women said to me, Pastor Hall, you're going to leave us? I said, well, by that time I'd not made any plans. And I said, well, I'm not too sure. And then she said, Pastor Hall, she said, it's very clear you've got a lot to give, but not here.
Wow.
And those words I don't think she saw the shock, but that was just exact words. And it was a month later, I think, I actually formally resigned, you know, said to the church, I'm going in 3 months' time.
Yeah.
So, and I think by that time I was becoming unwell, but I didn't realize how unwell I was.
Yeah, yeah.
And like any crisis, this was to do with ministry quite often. You know, working as a therapist, people normally come to see in a crisis, and one thing's a settled bit. You ask the question before the crisis, do you think you ignored signs?
Interesting, and, yes,
yeah, I ignored this. Yeah. Delroy, 3 or 4 years ago, I saw it coming, it was just a nudge, but I was thinking what people might say, and the same thing happened with me. What might people say? And, you know, in terms of creativity of ministry, and even though there'd been quite a lot of tension, but people really enjoyed what I did, you know, and so all these things go through your mind, but you're right, there's no model to kind of lead you out of it. Healthy.
Definitely. Okay, let's come back to journaling, because otherwise I'll just keep going down that route and we'll never get back to it. So if somebody's listening to this and they're kind of they've heard about this practice of journaling, or somebody like me who's kind of been told it's a helpful thing, you've given us some of the kind of the beneficial reasons, like what journaling brings to us. What does it look like in terms of what do you actually do? What kind of, nitty gritty, what does it look like on the ground for you?
Right. Now, this is how I do it.
Yeah.
And so there's only two rules about journaling. You date the page and you keep it in a place where nobody else can read it. That's it. So for me, I write prose. But for somebody, so there's an incident, I write about the incident, then I then begin to talk about how it made me feel and what it reminded me of. And sometimes I'll ask, what's going on? And I'll pause.
Yeah.
Okay. You can write journal in terms of bullet points. Now, people keep electronic journals, so you can put links in, photos, all that type of thing. And for people who are dyslexic,
you
can still journal. There's somebody I know, he's no longer pastoring, but he was dyslexic, but also very good at art.
Yeah.
So his journals were made up of artwork, but also he'd cut words out of magazines and stick them in the journal.
Yeah.
And individuals, another way of journaling is, so some people go for long walks and they have ideas in their mind, so they're kind of wrestling with the thoughts, but it's all kind of processing the walk.
Yeah.
Another way of journaling can be, you get your phone, you speak your reflection in it, and let it sit, go back to it two or three times, listen to it again, and what would you further say on reflection of what you've just heard?
Yeah, that's interesting, So it's almost like it, because for me, journaling, if I heard the word, it's very one-dimensional. It's a book and a pen and writing something down. But actually any method of recording and reflecting on, that's the key process.
Yeah. And if you draw, if you sketch quickly, your journal can be made up of sketches and maybe just a caption inside. It tells your story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when you're doing it, what are the key things you look for? What do you think it's helpful for people to kind of be thinking about or being aware of?
You never know what's going to pop up.
Yeah.
Also, in terms of journaling, there's loads of evidence now in terms of journaling or writing and well-being.
Mm.
So I'll say this, that... there's been times whereby in ministry whereby things were really crazy and I felt out of control, and the process of writing slowed me down.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Until I was able to kind of feel more in control again.
Yeah.
So just remind me of the question again. Remind me of the what you just asked.
What are people looking for? What kind of things should they be attentive of?
I think be open for surprises and unexpected learning.
Yeah.
So let me give you an example. At the time it was painful, but it said a lot to me. It's a few years ago now, so I was still in ministry, and it was in August. I had August off and I wasn't shaved. I'm loading the car up to go to Leicester to spend some time with my mum. Got a phone call, Delroy. I can't contact any of the ministers. Mrs. Bailey's in hospital and the doctors have said, you know, she hasn't got long left.
Yeah.
So basically, you know, could you come? And I'll be honest with you, I didn't want to because I was on holiday. Anyway, I got the stuff, turned up to the hospital, did the last rites, went into the next room. So this was August, and was then told she'd been in the hospital since May.
Oh, wow.
And I didn't know.
Yeah.
I know that she was unwell, so she didn't come to church much.
Yeah.
But her husband came, and I asked how she was and so forth. Anyway, I remember feeling really hurt by it all because I prided myself, if somebody's in the hospital, I visit within 24 hours.
Yeah, yeah.
So this thing, when I said, I was upset by it. So I didn't say anything to anybody at the time. Left the hospital, my wife came to pick me up. And I just said, I explained what happened. I said, look, I'm going to go back and speak to the family. Anyway, I went back and her husband said, I thought you were going. I said, yeah, but I need to speak to you and your children. I said, I didn't know that she was in so long. He just said to me, well, she only came in for observation, so we didn't think to say anything. Anyway, this thing really bothered me. And it bothered me. And I journaled about it for 3 or 4 days. On the fourth day, I think it was, it's as though the words came out the nib of the pen. I'll never forget it. Delroy, you're not upset by Mrs. Bailey being in hospital for so long.
Yeah.
you're really upset about is how people will view you as a pastor. That's what it was.
Yeah.
The moment those words hit the page, whatever I was feeling went.
Wow. Yeah.
And I realized what was the issue wasn't the fact that my lack of care for Mrs. Bailey, but how would people view me?
Yeah. Yeah.
So then it caused me to step back to think, why am I in ministry and all this type of thing and image? And yeah, so that was an experience that I'll never forget.
And that's really interesting how it didn't come immediately. It was kind of 3 or 4 days later, but you're kind of dwelling on it. And almost that sense of a phrase that gets used a lot in kind of charismatic Christian circles is kind of waiting on the Lord, we're waiting on the Lord, we're waiting on the Lord. But when you ask people, what does that mean? It's quite ill-defined.
Yeah, cool.
But that practice almost is a sense of like, I am diligent in and attentive. Because I know something's going on, and if something's going on, then the Lord wants to do something with it.
Yes,
and so in that sense, it's a waiting on the Lord kind of moment.
Indeed.
But doesn't necessarily look like your classic. I'm worshiping, or I'm soaking in the presence of God, or whatever it might be.
But
actually, possibly way more impactful, because it opens the doorway for God to do something.
It does. I think one of the things that my friend Delroy said to me, he said, Delroy says, when you're doing your doctoral work, remember it is still pastoral work. We think pastoral work is either the sermon on the Sunday or visiting someone.
Yeah, yeah.
But no, that brooding over a situation or that is still pastoral work.
Yeah.
And so it's just being aware. And even the books that we read to help us in ministry, it's very interesting with Eugene Peterson. I don't know if you've read his pastoral libraries, how he would put in his diary weeks and months in advance 2 hour reading slots.
Interesting.
So if anybody asked him, are you free on Sunday? He would say no. I've got an appointment. He never said what the appointment was, but he was reading.
Yeah.
That is still pastoral work.
Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
Yeah.
And so much of the process of journaling is focused on the self, in terms of that sense of I want to partner with God in his work of bringing me through to the image of Christ that he says I'm going to display. And actually investing time in doing that makes you a way better pastor.
Absolutely.
A way more attentive, kind of reflective, thoughtful, et cetera, et cetera, kind of person, which is what everybody wants their pastor to be, and what they hope they will be, but so often don't necessarily give them the time or space to be that.
No, and I think you've said something really, really important, that quite often, I guess my only tradition is Pentecostalism, but I think it's right across the board with pastors, we're just incredibly busy. But that, for me, journaling, being still, waiting on the Lord, what happens quite often in a crisis, you bring a presence into that crisis.
Definitely.
That I sometimes really create far more than a prayer or reading something from the scriptures. Some of the things I say to individuals, that when people go through a crisis, we think we need to come with great words, all the rest of it. No. What we underestimate is the gift of presence.
Yeah.
And I think the more that we're integrated, the more that we're whole, the more that we are self-aware, we just bring a better human being into this dynamic.
Yeah.
When individuals are going through some real crisis.
Yeah, and that's so important, because the presence is not just that, if you like, the atoms and the molecules just happen to be in the same place.
Yeah.
It's the presence of a centeredness, the presence of a kind of an ability to hold this situation and be available for somebody.
Yes.
When that is in a situation that the whole situation can kind of keep moving forward, and people can kind of, if it's a pastoral situation, engage with their grief, whatever it might be. But when the presence is a very scatty kind of a presence that's kind of distracted by lots of things, or somebody just bringing in lots of unprocessed emotion and feeling about things that have happened. You bring that into the situation as well.
Yes,
and
indeed.
You know, I think that's a really helpful descriptor of what kind of presence is important, but to some extent why we crave the presence of God. Because it's not just, you know, it's not this idea that he's physically in the same location as us alone. It's that sense of actually when God is present, he's the God who brings order into chaos and brings peace into situations.
It's interesting, Dave. I think you know that I was, well, until 3 weeks ago, I was a chaplain for Sheffield United Football Club. Yeah. I'm not now.
Yeah.
I resigned. Long story, but I won't notice to go into. But what I did, I wrote the resignation letter to the senior leadership team, but also the people I'd become friends with, because I was leaving so sudden, I then sent them the letter.
Yeah.
But what was interesting, quite a few people, when they responded, they spoke about my presence being in the place. And quite often football, you just don't talk about faith. You just don't. It's a very hard culture. But quite a few emails said that it was the presence that I brought into the gym, or the training room, or the treatment room. And it's only now as we're talking. And I think that's come about by, for me, journaling. And now I'm really very much involved in contemplative prayer.
Yeah.
Holding around being still. The spiritual disciplines are another, we won't major on that now, but the spiritual disciplines are really good because it slows us down.
Yeah.
I think the point that you make, if you are a hurried, fragmented self, that's what you bring. And I'm suggesting that if we do journaling in a way that heightens our self-awareness and so forth, we bring a quality of humanity into a difficult situation.
That's such a helpful phrase, statement, summary, Delroy, of where we've gone. I feel like you convinced me that journaling's a good thing.
I think it is. I've only been doing it for 22 years. I think it's a good thing.
I found it really helpful when you were talking about the different ways that people journal. Mm-hmm. I definitely am a kind of walk through the nature kind of person. And some of that it takes me away from the laptop, takes me away from, you know, the books, takes me away from the emails. And it just puts me in a place where I'm like, well, all I can do now is either pray or think or let things rise to the surface. But that's so helpful. It's that kind of sense of what's going to come out. And like you were saying, sometimes it's the most surprising thing. And it's almost like your subconscious gets a moment to, it gets some airtime, and it's like, FYI, this is going on in the background, and it's helpful that you're aware of it.
Yeah, of course.
That's really helpful, Delroy. Well, for anybody listening, I hope this will go out beginning of 2024. And so it may be that new year, new starts. It might be that journaling is something that you want to take up, want to engage in. Any resources you recommend, Delroy? You mentioned earlier, I think it was a book by McDonald called Ordering Your Private World.
It's a really good devotional book. And one of the things he said, that when he didn't journal, it meant that he was too busy.
Interesting.
I found the same thing. So Ordering Your Private World is a good one. The other one that's a really good book, which is not a Christian book, but it's really, really helpful, is Journal to the Self by Kathleen Adams. And she has 22 different ways of journaling. Brilliant book.
That's really helpful.
Yeah, really accessible.
So what was that was called? Journal to the Self.
Yeah, by Kathleen Adams.
Kathleen Adams.
Yeah.
Brilliant. That's so helpful, Delroy. Well, listeners have got a couple of recommendations to go off, but to some extent also just give it a go and start.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Start reflecting. So we thank you.
66 days. 66 days to start a new habit. There you go.
66 days. Oh, I thought it was 40. Oh, that's why none of my habits stick. I keep bailing at 40. Okay, 66 days. I'll make a note of that. Well, Delroy, thank you so much for being on the podcast. Thank you, everyone, for listening. If you'd like to find out more about Lee School of Theology, just Google us. We'll come up as the first hit. If you would like to sign up to any of our courses, you can find out the information on our website. And if you'd like to give to the work of the school, there's details about how to do that as well. We will be back. Oh, no. Theo's going to have to edit that last bit. It's just me choking to death. Let me do a final line.
Okay.
We will be back with another We will be back with another podcast very shortly, and we're looking forward to connecting with you soon. God bless everyone. Bye.